We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Credit Suisse and nine other Swiss banks are being targeted. The head of the Swiss Bankers Association says Switzerland must avoid a repeat of the deal it made to settle a U.S. investigation against UBS Bank last year. In that deal, Swiss banking secrecy laws were bent to reveal the details of around 4,000 U.S. clients. Last month, Switzerland struck deals with Germany and Britain to tax money kept in secret Swiss accounts and introduce a withholding tax on future interest earned, but Washington has rejected such a proposal. Banking secrecy laws have helped Switzerland build up a $2 trillion offshore financial industry, but the country has cooperated in hunting tax cheats in recent years amidst the global crackdown on tax havens.
That's Eleanor Beardsley reporting, and I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org.
Programs on WILL are made possible by Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
From PRX and NPR, you're listening to State of the Reunion. I'm Al Letson, and every episode we travel the country and examine the things that bring us together and the issues that pull us apart. We try to really get to know a city, town, or area and tell stories about the American people, our connection to each other, and to the land. This week, we're in northern New Mexico. It's just before 6 a.m. The sun is slowly starting to peak over the Sangre de Cristo Mountains. It's summertime, but at this hour, you'll still need a heavy sweater. Miguel Santesteban is used to the cold. Every morning he crawls out of his bed, steps outside of his humble home in Taos, New Mexico, and starts the day by playing his wooden flute.
And every morning I gotta turn the water on for our irrigators. We've got about 135 members.
Miguel is the supervisor of an acequia.
It's an irrigation system here that's been in existence since the mid-1700s.
And since its inception, whole communities have formed around this tradition. Now, in many parts of the country, water's not a big deal. It falls from the sky, or we get it from an aquifer, and we tend to not think about it. But in northern New Mexico, there are few things more important than water, and the unique way people here have collected and shared this precious resource for centuries.
When I was growing up, you know, all I really knew, I didn't know the acequias were like 11,000 years old and went back to the Middle East and had all this rich culture attached to it. All I knew is that, you know, it was flowing water, and me and my brother would jump in it and catch frogs and fish and snakes.
An acequia is basically an irrigation ditch that carries water to farmers' fields. There are over 1,000 of them in the state of New Mexico. Miguel himself is a biologist and a farmer, but he's also the mayordomo of his acequia, an elected official who oversees the distribution of water to other farmers in his area.
You know, we're a local government. This is our water system, you know. This acequia is older than the United States. You know, the United States is what, 1776? This acequia is about 25 years older than that.
Each acequia has its own mayordomo. For literally thousands of years, these ditches have been used to distribute water to indigenous communities around the world. In New Mexico, water has been shared communally for as long as anyone can remember. It belongs to no one, and yet to everyone. It's a very different way of looking at water than most of us Americans are used to.
The way we deal with it is we measure water in units of time. You get the water for 8 hours, or you get the water for 4 hours. You get the water in proportion to amount of land that you're irrigating.
And you measuring the water in time is something that's been passed down from generations. That's nothing new, right?
Yeah, that's ancient history down to, you know, the origin of the acequia. And that's completely antithetical to how the state does it.
And while the acequia system is based on community and cooperation, being a mayordomo isn't easy. Miguel learned this years ago before he was elected. At the time, he was trying to irrigate his field in the middle of June. It was a dry year, and the water from the acequia wasn't making it to all of his crops.
And I called the mayordomo, and I was like, somebody's stealing my water. And he's all, nobody's stealing your water. There's no more water. This is one of those years. And I said, come on, man. I just need like 10 more feet to get to the end of my row. Someone has to be stealing my water. And, you know, and he said again, Miguel, and this is the part I like. He said, Miguel, I am the mayordomo. I am not God. Do you want me to pick you up and take you to the river? There is no more water in the river. It's one of those years.
And that's the kind of place New Mexico is. A land that forces you to deal with hard reality. When I got off the plane, it seemed like I'd landed in another world. A planet in a faraway solar system, its orbit too close to the sun. Desert as far as the eye can see. It's arid, unforgiving, and in summertime, extremely hot. But at the same time, it's also beautiful. Peaceful. In the midst of these two opposing visions of the land runs the Rio Grande, the river that's given life to the people of this area for centuries.
The Tewa people, that included the, it still includes the pueblos of San Ildefonso, San Juan, Santa Clara, Pohuake, Cayumungue, Tesuque, and Lambe. My name is Jack Leffler, originally came from West Virginia. I've lived in New Mexico since 1962. For the last 35 or 40 years, I've made my way as a, what I call, aural historian, A-U-R-A-L historian.
Europeans arrived here in 1598 when the Spanish conquistador Juan de Oñate and a group of settlers claimed the land right where the Rio Chama and the Rio Grande rivers meet. The Spaniards brought cattle, Catholicism, and acequias.
And one of the first things they did was to dig a ditch system that diverted water off of the rivers there. My name is Sylvia Rodriguez. I've been a professor of anthropology in the Department of Anthropology at the University of New Mexico for about 22 years.
That whole acequia system actually jived or coalesced very well with some of the Puebloan practices of irrigation that were taking place prior to the coming of the Spanish in 1598.
And over time, old and new mixed together, and the water ran through.
You have, with the Pueblo peoples and the Spanish and then the Mexican settlers and farmers, peoples who are both depending on the same sources of water and who develop systems for the sharing of water and for the distribution of water and for the management of water that they have in common.
The acequia itself connotes a state of reciprocity with the land where you're living. And so it's not just the culture, it's the culture within the context of the landscape. And once that happens, then the landscape becomes homeland and the culture becomes rooted.
They came. They put down their roots until it was hard to see where the earth stopped and their feet began. They dug acequias to let the water flow to their crops. Land passed down from generation to generation, and with it a way of life. And acequias remained the cornerstone through the Mexican-American War, through the building of the railroads, to joining the Union and beyond. Until in the middle of the 20th century.
This is the place where the atom bomb was created. The nuclear economy transformed New Mexico, transformed the Rio Grande Corridor, transformed education and urban development. So you have a kind of vulnerability of the native population and an increasing inability to hold on to their patrimony.
In the coming decades, the Sun Belt expanded, and outsiders flowed into New Mexico from the Midwest, from the East, from California, all looking for a more pristine, more enchanted life, where blue skies are only interrupted by red-hued mesas. Northern New Mexico began to look a lot like other American cities, developments, strip malls, and modern living steadily paving over the ancient ways of the acequia. We're in the checkout line at Walmart, in the town of Española. Today, there are only a handful of full-time farmers left here. Over the years, people have transitioned into jobs with government, the Los Alamos Labs, the Walmart. Many of them are still active acequia members, as they still grow their food and raise sheep, but only on the side.
But at one time when we were growing up, you never saw a car go through this highway over here. You'd see a team of horses pulling a wagon, and that's it. And then all of a sudden you get all this traffic through here, and it's not the most pleasant thing in the world.
Joe Murhige taught in the public schools for years, but for the past few decades, he's been farming his land full-time. His gorgeous 16 acres sits directly across from the Walmart.
We owned the land where Walmart is. We had an orchard there. We used to plant chili.
Joe never married, never had kids, and so when he passes, the land will go to his sisters. And since they're not farmers, they'll likely sell it. For years, developers have been calling, asking to buy his prime real estate, the missing piece in an economic puzzle.
This land's worth a lot of money, in the millions, okay? I want you to know that. But money is not all that important to me. You know, at this stage of the game, or at any time, I never have been a materialistic person. You know, I taught school for $2,000 a year. What am I going to do with $4 or $5 million?
The contrast between the old world represented by Joe's farm and the new one with Walmart across the street is stunning. One day, the new world will come knocking, and Joe won't be there to say no. And his little farm will become another loss in the war between tradition and progress.
And nowadays, when we look at acequias, you know, if you're a developer or a politician, the first thing you might think is water or water rights.
Miguel Santesteban.
But those of us who work the acequia, the first thing we think is community.
As the economy has shifted away from small farms to strip malls and big box retail, many people have sold their land and transferred their water rights to developers. These developers don't use the acequias. Many times they bulldoze over them, or at the very least they don't maintain the ditch. And that's the key. You see, the acequia system needs everyone to participate to keep the water flowing. When the ditch needs to be maintained, the entire community is expected to come out and work on it. But with fewer farmers and more development, the flow of water is being interrupted. And in northern New Mexico, water is everything.
It's the lifeblood. People say that around here all the time, but it's for real. It's everything.
Margarita Garcia is Miguel's wife, and like her husband, she sees the importance of the acequias, not just for watering crops.
I wouldn't have the language, the Spanish that I have. We wouldn't have those words. We wouldn't have the songs. We wouldn't have the music, because the people wouldn't have been able to come to this place and live in this place if there wasn't water, because they couldn't survive here. So it's everything. It is my entire culture.
Corre corriente que al fin por ahí vas a parar.
As the older generation of farmers fades away, people like Miguel and Margarita are becoming crusaders for this ancient tradition. Miguel started a program that teaches New Mexico youth how to document what they've learned from the acequia with films and slideshows. And legislation has been passed that gives more power to the acequia system in its struggle with developers. Across the country, water rights have become a contentious issue, states fighting each other for this limited resource. Solutions to this problem seem hard to come by, and yet, for hundreds of years, communities in northern New Mexico have figured out how to make it work. Back at the acequia, Miguel's day ends the same way it began.
Yeah, twice a day, 6 a.m. and 6 p.m.
He is the gatekeeper of this centuries-old system, and his nightly task is turning this rusty metal wheel that controls the flow of water to his ditch. See video and pictures of the acequias, go to stateoftheunion.com.
Como corriente de las acequias corre la vida. Como corriente de las acequias corre la vida. Con sus zacates y su filito y su alegría.
Coming up on State of the Reunion, another tradition is passed down to the next generation. But maybe that's not such a good thing.
WILL stations are sustained through special gifts from people like you, who recognize the value of Illinois public media. By naming WILL in your estate plans, you'll make an investment in the future of quality news, information, entertainment, and children's programs. For information about our Legacy Circle, call Don DeBeard at 217-333-7300 or visit online at will.illinois.edu/support.
WILL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois.
Programs on WILL are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting audiences to explore over 17 free performances and events at El Nora, the Guitar Festival 2011, September 8th, 9th, and 10th. More information is at elnoraguitarfestival.com.
Welcome back to State of the Reunion. Today we're in the Española Valley of northern New Mexico.
Okay, my name is Cipriano Frederico Vigil. I'm a folk musician and educator and composer and author. All rolled into one. I perform traditional New Mexican folk music all over the country and even abroad. Well, I grew up with this music as a young boy. Maybe about 8 years old, I used to go to the dances and with a little notepad and a paper, and I would take notes of the musicians where they would place their fingers on the guitars, and this is how I taught myself how to play. Why I specialize in the traditional folk music of New Mexico. Of course, I also write in the style of La Nueva Canción, the new song form, which is based on folk elements, you know, like acequias, ditches, the mud plasters of homes, and anything that has to do with the culture, I write about that. Well, the musician in the communities here, all the way from the, since I can remember, probably even from my time, the time of my grandfather or my great-grandfather, has always played a major role. They could count on him for the rituals, like when there was a baptism or when there was a wedding, for funerals, to do the alabados. So the musician was a respected person in the community and has continued to this day. Musicians are looked upon, you know, as a great part of the culture because of their contribution and always being there, you know, for anything. Se ve triste el hombre. The man looks sad. The story of this song is about a man from northern New Mexico that looks sad. And why is he sad? Well, he lost his water rights. He lost his land. He lost, at times, a loved one or his own life.
Entra el hombre cuartonero a las entrañas de la sierra. Sacan todos los pinos y nos dejan sin madera. Sacan todos los pinos y nos dejan sin madera. Se ve triste el hombre de la sierra, pues destrozaron la naturaleza.
Cipriano's music feels like the soundtrack to northern New Mexico. His voice rises and falls like the landscape, his guitar carrying the feeling of the wind, and the stories he weaves are born out of the little towns that spring up on the sides of the highway in the Española Valley. Like the people here, his verses are full of hope and pride, but also tragedy. How long does the high last? Was there one?
It depends on all, like just like everything else, the quality of it, and how long you've been using and how much you use. Me, I was up to probably 2-3 grams a day, so I would do half of it in the morning to get well, what they'd say, well, you know, feel better from the withdrawal symptoms. And that would last maybe 5 to 6 hours.
Joe is 27 and is a recovering heroin addict. Looking at him, you wouldn't know that he struggles with addiction, but when he speaks openly about his problems, you can see the weariness in his eyes.
Withdrawal symptoms, what comes on is a lot of anxiety. You know, you get anxiety attacks through your legs, your arms. You start to cold sweat, vomit, diarrhea, just totally uncomfortable. And insomnia, you try to break cold turkey, it's 7 to 10 days before you'll get a couple hours sleep at that, and maybe a month before you get a full night's rest.
Like so many people here, Joe has been around heroin his entire life.
I've seen it since probably the day I was born, when I don't realize it, because my uncles, my cousins, my older brother have all been heroin addicts. I've seen them in and out of treatment centers, jail, trying to kick on their own, you know. And it's a powerful substance to kick when it's just so abundant around the area.
Driving through the Española Valley, you wouldn't know it, but heroin addiction and overdoses are higher per capita here than anywhere else in the country. Now, that statistic clashes with my own perception of drug use. The canyons, deserts, and small clusters of homes that dot the valley bear little resemblance to the drug dens of inner cities or the suburbs. But heroin is here and has been a part of life in this area for some time.
My name is Christian Lopez. I'm the lieutenant with the Española Police Department. I mean, the 80s, you had your pot smokers. Cocaine was coming up. Heroin wasn't really a big issue back then. When I started back in 89, it wasn't even anything that we were dealing with. We didn't start dealing with the heroin problem till like 94, 95, around there. Right around that time when it started getting, it like hit us. It was just like a bad storm that just hit us. And we started noticing the overdoses.
Lieutenant Lopez attributes part of the problem to the drug cartels across the border in Mexico.
They filter right into Española, and then from Española they kind of branch out. From Española they can hit the entire Southwest, into Arizona, Colorado, Denver, even into Utah and up into the southern part of California. So Española being the holding area, if you will, for that large amount of narcotics that come through here.
But there's more to it than just drugs filtering in from Mexico.
The roots of the problem are very, very deep, and they go back to this history of dispossession, of loss of land, of language, of, you know, sense of self-respect. My name is Angela Garcia, and I'm a professor of anthropology at UC Irvine, and I also write.
Angela just finished a book, The Pastoral Clinic, about heroin addiction in the Valley.
Well, I grew up in New Mexico, in Albuquerque, South Valley, which shares a lot of similar social problems as the Española Valley. And I didn't intend to do this for my work, but when I was in graduate school, every time I would come home, you know, there would be another overdose, or my mother would call me and tell me that, you know, so-and-so had died. And I was working on a very unrelated project, but I just kept coming home to New Mexico, and the devastation that was really caused by drugs, just, you know, it was where my heart was and where my mind was. And so I switched my project midway through my graduate career and began working in northern New Mexico, where, of course, the problem with heroin is really the most sort of tragic.
Well, you know, what's striking to me about everything you're saying is that this is really kind of a generational curse. Like, it's staying within families, like it's being passed down in families.
Absolutely. I mean, I remember one woman talking to me about her abscesses that she had on her arms, and she described them as a wound. But she also said to me that you know, her mother had them too. So she didn't feel as bad about the way her body appeared, it being, you know, heavily marked, because it was a body that her mother shared. And so there's something very perverse about that, but also something very understandable. Children and parents using together, in a way, it releases the stigma of being an addict.
How this region became a hotspot of drug use is tied up in both historical and economic issues.
A lot of old-timers I talked about, you know, first getting high in East L.A., coming back to the Española Valley with addictions. You know, the following generation would speak to me about going to Vietnam and getting hooked on Vietnam and then coming back and bringing drugs back with them. A lot of people point their fingers at the hippies that moved in the 1960s and early 70s. They're them, that sort of alternative generation bringing in drugs. But the bottom line is that drugs, alcohol have been there, you know, really for generations. And they've been used by people locally to help cope with what is a really deep sense of loss and pain that people feel in that region.
Starting with the Great Depression, it became increasingly difficult for farmers to make a living here. Then came World War II, and with it the opening of the Los Alamos Labs.
Here in the New Mexico desert, in December 1942, the first major steps were taken to bring forth an atomic bomb, an awesome power unknown to previous civilizations.
Locals left their fields and took jobs as plumbers, carpenters, and custodians in and around the labs. Farms struggled to survive in this new landscape and were sold or lost. Water rights evaporated. And suddenly, a people whose collective identity had been tied to the soil were left wondering, who are we now?
These are formerly agricultural communities, and when the Los Alamos National Laboratories came in, it really transformed the local economy.
In an unprecedented effort, thousands of scientists and engineers throughout the country were enlisted to create an atomic bomb.
Yeah, if you meet with 100 clients and you sit down and you say to them, why did you start drinking? 99% of them will tell you, because I didn't feel good about myself. My name is Ben Tafoya. I'm the executive director of OI Recovery Program.
Ben Tafoya has been running OI for the last 12 years. He's a tall man and looks like he walked out of a Clint Eastwood Western with his black Wrangler shirt and cowboy boots. He has an easy smile, but there's also a seriousness about him.
You know, there's a saying that says, if you don't know where you come from, you don't know where you're at, and you don't know where you're going.
OI is a publicly funded residential drug and alcohol treatment program. The facility sits on 32 acres of arid land in the small community of Velarde, just north of Española. The property has a small farm with livestock, including a llama and peacocks. There's a small campus for counseling, classes, living, and dining. At any given time, there are about 30 residents in treatment here. They'll stay between 30 and 90 days.
Part of what we try to do here is establish a more culturally appropriate process of treatment. Not that we do away with best practices. They have their place.
And as culturally appropriate treatment, OI offers a range of alternative therapies: gardening, acupuncture, meditation, poetry, painting.
So that's where the client's going.
Ben removes a heavy metal door from a round structure and we peer inside. It's a sweat lodge made from adobe, decorated with colorful murals.
So they go in there, they have the stones, they do the steaming. See, the typical sweat lodge was established primarily for warriors that were going off to war. This is an Aztec sweat lodge. This was established more as a spiritual strengthening of the individual.
It's difficult to gauge how much of an impact OI is having because overdose rates remain high. In a group session in the facility, Counselor Jose Lopez tells us that heroin-related deaths have gone down, but the amount of general drug overdoses has stayed the same.
The rest are dying from opiates like Oxycontin, Percocets, Valiums, but now they're also into the benzodiazepines.
The faces of the residents here are varied, young and old, all trying to turn their lives around. When Jose tells us about the dangers of drug use, many of his students nod their head in agreement.
Anybody have anything they would like to share?
Well, I have a comment. Yeah. It just seems, you know, like there's such an epidemic of drugs in this country that,
you know, actually there should be quite a bit more rehabilitations for drug addicts. And, you know, I feel that the laws are a little backwards as far as, you know, incarcerating everybody because you're a drug addict. You know, in many cases when you're incarcerated, you don't get the treatment that would be great if you could get it. Because sometimes you're just locked up in a cell, you know, 6x6, and you're just locked up for days and in many cases years, which is really, really sad to see.
Linda is in her 60s and started using heroin after going through a tough divorce.
25 years is a long time to have, you know, a mate, and suddenly I didn't have him anymore. And I couldn't handle the pain. I didn't know how to handle that pain. So I started using drugs, hard drugs. And before I knew it, I was doing crime to support my habit. And I landed up in the Women's Correctional Facility in Grants, New Mexico.
Linda was released from the correctional facility and sent to this program. And at the time of our interview, she'd only been here a couple weeks. When I asked her about her prospects when she leaves, she had high hopes but no concrete plans. The utilitarian halls of Oi feel safe and sterile, but outside its gates, the same conditions that brought these men and women here exist. Professor Angela Garcia worked the night shift at Oi and understands the challenges firsthand.
The battle that they're up against is too big for them alone. You know, the depth of the problems, the complexity of the problems of drugs are so deep that not one drug program can handle it all. And unfortunately, they're really the only game in town, and it's just too much for them. So, you know, it's less a criticism of Oi and more a criticism of the fact that there's not enough support.
Back in June, the Española Police Department, along with state and federal agents, arrested 24 suspected dealers in the valley.
Oh, Mike, both indictments for the operation in Las Cruces and Española read like small phone books, and both put a dent in drug operations in New Mexico. The drug enforcement...
The raid might have temporarily put a dent in drug use, but Lieutenant Christian Lopez told us that dealers would soon be back to business as usual.
You know, long term, I think we're going to kind of settle back into that plateau that we were at before.
The police department is constantly dealing with county and state budget cuts. They can't afford to coordinate big drug raids on a regular basis. Meanwhile, drug cartels in Mexico continue to move their packages across the border. For any substantive change to occur, Angela Garcia thinks recovery and rehabilitation need to be looked at from a much more comprehensive perspective.
Rehab that addresses the needs and problems of the entire family, and that would have to include mental health. That would have to include rehab programs that allowed mothers and their children to be in rehab together and to not be separated, which is currently what happens.
Taking the dirt road on our drive from Oi, we passed a cemetery on the outskirts of a small neighborhood. This was different than any graveyard I'd ever seen. It didn't look somber and stately, nor was it neglected and sad. Instead, it was filled with vivid colors, beads, statues of Jesus and the saints. Bright plastic flowers were on almost every plot. It was a celebration of life in a place where we tend to think of death. I couldn't help but wonder how many people buried here died because of drugs. You wouldn't know it by looking at their tombstones, just like you wouldn't know that the people here in the valley are dealing with an epidemic. It's hidden from the casual visitor's eye. I don't know what I was expecting. Addicts in the middle of the street, syringes on the ground, I don't know. But what I found was a community, like many other cities or towns across America, struggling with a problem, but somehow finding a way to get by.
You know, people are strung out and people are hurting, but they're also, you know, taking care of business, feeding each other, you know, paying their bills, working jobs, you know, addicts working at Walmart, addicts working at McDonald's, addicts, you know, trying to maintain. And so that's a perspective that is often lost. That certainly, I think, is one that we have to remember.
Be sure to stop by stateoftheunion.com, where you can see slideshows, videos, and other stories about the Española Valley. In our next segment, we look at the long and winding history of lowriders in what's been called the lowrider capital of the world.
The creativity and the talent and the skill and the imagination that goes into these vehicles, It's art. I mean, it's not any different than a piece that's hanging on a wall in a gallery anywhere.
Next up on State of the Reunion. Support for State of the Reunion comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, a growing network of listeners, producers, and stations collaborating to make public radio more public. PRX.org.
Tune in to WILL-TV Wednesday evening for special programming to mark the 10th anniversary of September 11th, 2001. First at 8, follow the 5-year construction of the National September 11th Memorial Museum on NOVA, Engineering at Ground Zero. Then at 9, explore how people's beliefs and non-beliefs have been challenged since September 11th on Frontline, Faith and Doubt at Ground Zero. That's Wednesday evening on WILL-TV.
WILL programs are made possible by Women's Health Practice and Dr. Suzanne Troopin, offering obstetrics, gynecology, and fertility services on Neal Street in Champaign. Women's Health Practice is a Health Alliance medical plan provider and is accepting new patients. More information is available at womenshealthpractice.com.
Welcome back to State of the Reunion. Today we're in northern New Mexico in the Española Valley. The region is made up of small pueblos and towns, many that have been here for centuries.
So there's a lot of history in this little town of El Rito. My family were the Archuletas and the Herreras. You know, they just keep traveling until they got to where they wanted to be. My great-grandfather was Juan de la Cruz Herrera. And then he had his son, his name was Rubel. That was my grandfather. And then his son's name was Pedro. And then here I am. I'm Nicolás Herrera. They call me El Santero del Rito, the saint maker of El Rito.
As a saint maker, Nicholas carves wooden interpretations of Catholic saints and angels. He also paints bright and evocative scenes and landscapes on wooden slabs. He uses red, green, and yellow paint that make his work radiate.
So this is our patron saint of our church in El Rito, San Juan de Pomuceno. That's made out of cottonwood, pine. Yeah, mostly it's wood, and then sometimes I get into metal, found objects.
A lot of his work is, of course, rooted in religion, but Nicholas himself rarely goes to church and is just as interested in motorcycles and modern life as historic Catholic figures, and his work reflects that.
This is about the land. It's called Mi Agua y la Tierra No Se Vende. The water and the land is not for sale. See, here's the realtor with a BMW and the lawyer. And here's me and my wife that I'll have maybe someday. And he's like telling him, you know, get out of here. You know what I mean? This land is not for sale. And here's the farm. Here's my farm. So my work, I speak with my art.
Nicholas's family has been here since the 1700s when they settled the area as a land grant.
So now it's going to be passed. This is going to be passed on to my daughter. It's been great because I don't have to punch the clock. I don't have to say anything to anybody. I don't have to say yes, ma'am, no, ma'am, yes, sir, whatever. No, it's like get up and I do my art. I feel that, you know, there's like little angels or something like telling me, okay, this is, don't go like that. All of a sudden you have a plan and it turns out something else. So there's got to be another power there.
Okay, so one thing this episode needs is more cowbell, please. Now, when you hear that sound, you know it's coming. And there is no way we could do this next piece without playing this song. My producer tried to keep it out, but I'm sorry. It's obligatory.
All my friends know the lowrider.
I was surprised to learn that Española is considered by many the lowrider capital of the world. It has a long history here.
I can remember my dad had some when he was, well, when he was my age now. He's 76 now. But he had pictures of old 53, 59 Chevys, 61 Impalas, and some were low. But I remember seeing them everywhere. My name is Rupert Padilla, and I'm from Chimayo, New Mexico.
For Rupert, low riders are essential, just like air, water, and food. He can't remember a time when they weren't a part of his life.
I've had 56 Chevy, Bel Air, 58 Apache truck pickup, 64 Impala, Super 76 Grand Prix, 69 Ford Galaxy, 65 pickup.
You've probably seen a low rider before. If not in your own town, then maybe on TV. Traditionally, it's a vintage American car, often a Chevy, that sits much lower to the ground than factory models. Stunning paint jobs, eye-popping rims, ear-popping sound systems. If a lowrider is on your street, you can't help but notice it. There's an ongoing debate about where they started. Now, some say it was in L.A., while others, especially around here, insist that it was Española. Somewhere along the way, the lowrider capital of the world became Española's nickname, and it stuck.
My dad, I remember once he said he put one of them round troughs like those from the feed store, and he filled them with sand and rocks, and that would lower the car for the weight. Then he put it in the trunk and fill it with heavy stuff, and it would lower the car.
Technology, though, has caught up with the ambitions and dreams of lowrider enthusiasts. No longer do they need sandbags and rocks. They've got hydraulics and mechanics who specialize in giving a car that low profile.
The creativity and the talent and the skill and the imagination that goes into these vehicles, it's art. I mean, it's not any different than a piece that's hanging on a wall in a gallery anywhere. My name is Randy Peraglio. I'm from Espanola, New Mexico, born and raised. Oh, back in the early 80s up into the 90s, I painted every frickin' lowrider car in this town. There wasn't a car in this town that didn't have one of my murals on it.
Most people agree that the first lowriders originated sometime around the 1940s or 50s, but the tradition of cruising goes back even further.
Back in the 1870s, they would take, after church, they would get their wagons, decorate the wagons and the horses, and wear their finest clothes, and cruise the plaza. So this is a tradition that goes way back.
So we are in Alamosa, Colorado, and we're at a car show, lowrider show. You know, I'd say probably somewhere around 300-400 people out here. And the people who brought the cars up, the show cars, they're just camping out in tents and, you know, playing with their kids. And it's a really cool scene.
It's a 66 Mustang.
It's a 76 Oldsmobile Cutlass.
It's a lowrider bicycle.
We came up here because we heard that there was going to be a lot of people from the Espanola Valley up here with their cars. And sure enough, we hit the sweet spot. We found a place where about four or five different people are camped out with their cars. It's really elevated, like taking care of your car to an art form.
I am the president of the club here at Rolling Deep. I'm Chris Quintana. We've had 16 years of having car shows, and it's been fun. I'm just looking, scoring cars on points, on body modifications, different, you know, glass, pinstriping, paint, murals, authenticity, you know, difference between one or the other. We're going to have a hop here at 3 o'clock where these cars hop off the hydraulics.
Sure enough, at 3 p.m., hundreds of people form a huge circle in the parking lot. One at a time, a new contestant pulls his car into the center of the circle to literally test the limits of his hydraulics. Pressurized liquids enable these cars to bounce up high on their back wheels. And that's the objective of this competition. The driver doesn't actually sit in the car for this. Instead, he stands next to it with a remote that controls the hydraulics from a close but safe distance. Cars with the best hydraulics have been known to jump over 70 inches.
My name is Fred Rael. I'm actually an electrician, and I'm the president of the Espanola chapter of Prestigious Car Club. I'm also one of the founding members. We started back in 1993, and we've been going strong ever since then.
Fred's car is a 1964 grayish-brown Chevy Impala, and his gold-plated accessories shine in the sun. A small crowd forms around the vehicle as he sits on custom leather seats with the convertible top down.
I had a friend of mine that had him do the pinstripes on the car, had him stripe the whole car just to change it up a little bit. I added a Continental kit in the back. I put an airbag set up, that way I could let it sit real low to the ground and still be able to cross the speed bumps to get it home and inside the garage. The interior is all redone in the original pattern.
Do you meet up with other lowriders in Espanola and kind of ride around together, or is it more like just hooking up to look at the work that you're doing?
Well, we used to all ride as a club. We used to get together and ride and all that. And it's really hard to now because the police really don't like it when we come out and stuff, when there's more than one or two cars out.
One thing that strikes me about this gathering is that it's a family affair, and that runs squarely against the gangster stereotype of lowriders.
Most everybody that's into lowriders nowadays, we all have jobs and we all have families and all that. I don't know why they insist on, you know, if you see three or four in a parking lot, they insist on chasing us out of there.
To be fair to the police, the large speakers that I see in the back of most of these cars might be part of the problem. But many of the drivers we talk to felt it's the perception of who they are and not what they do that attracts the police attention. Whatever the reasons, lowriders don't really cruise here anymore.
Late 70s, early 80s, you couldn't go out to town at any time and not see lowriders. There wasn't a time of day, night, or whatever, middle of the night. I mean, there's people that used to come out at 1 in the morning and come cruising. And it used to be so, you know, they're so widespread through the whole community. On the weekends, I mean, you'd see 100, 200 cars just cruising.
Randy Peraglio wants to bring the car culture back in a big way. He looks at it as folk art and a possible economic engine for the region.
In our downtown area here in Espanola, close to the plaza, there's a great old dealership that's just sitting vacant and empty now because of the economy. And we would like to use that building to do a lowrider museum, to capitalize on the lowrider culture here and Espanola's reputation as the lowrider capital of the country, of the world, whatever you want it to be. And show how it evolved, like I say, from the 1870s or however it was to what it is now. And show how it's progressed, because it's a history that's been around for over 100 years, you know, basically cruising.
Now, it's one thing to talk about lowriders and a whole different ball of wax to actually see them. But if you go to stateoftheReunion.com, you can see a video documentary that we made on these lowriders. That's stateoftheReunion.com.
Andando por las calles, buscando un amor, paseando en mi carro, buscando un amor.
Now, if you've heard our show before, you know we often ask residents to pen a letter to the place that they call home. And this letter comes to us from a local writer.
Well, my name is Luis Peña, and I'm from the small village of Servieta Plaza, which is just north of Española. And my entire family is a family of artists and poets, and musicians, activists, and most importantly, dreamers. Northern New Mexico, I don't think that I've ever taken the time to tell you how much you mean to me. As a kid, I looked up to you. You gave me the dance, matachine, pueblo, and the late night rancheras. You gave me the alabado, al hurricane, and logical nonsense, all at once, and I was blown away. Somewhere in the back of my memory, I can still hear my great-grandfather playing guitar and singing in the wee hours of the night as I drift off to sleep. In my dreams, I can see your creation, the deep reds of Abiquiú, the golden hues of Tierra María, the ivory white of Plaza Blanca, and the darkened earth of Black Mesa. And I'm flying. In my dreams, I am flying in and out of time zones. No layovers. I can peer through gallery walls to see the ghettos of Analco. I can see the electric poles disappear from the panorama of my vision. And I see you, mi norte, young and beautiful. You are content to live life in the arid desert and to drink from the mouth of the Rio Grande like warm cafecito in the early morning. You have made me a home among the yucca, Anasazi ruins, penitente moradas, and cottonwood bosques. And when you wake up in the morning, the horizon cracks open with the sound of birds, wind, and the heat of a new day. Every day, you give me the chance at making my home a better place to live, to improve upon my mistakes, and to enjoy every moment. Mi Norte, when I see the shadows of the Sangre de Cristo and Emes Mountains, where your memory stretches back across the expanse of time to an era of sweetgrass and cornmeal prayers, my people brought you domestication, old world ideals, and the Roman Catholic cross. We lived and died under three sovereigns, Spain, Mexico, and the United States of America, all the while deep in your embrace. And now, we are in a new place, no? Now your time is filled with economic development, 24-hour casinos, and nuclear weapons facilities. They keep you busy with commuter trains and gallery openings, but we both know that you own the night. When the sun sets, your children come out to play among the spatter of constellations. I remember living with you when time did not march forward linearly, but intentionally and with style. Careful on your way home. It's super blitz time, and the hulas have a quota to keep. Tell my grandparents that I miss them, and I'm still working on my degree. Bueno, laters. Thank you for everything. Love, Luis Peña.
so many ways, the Española Valley has proven to be a place that remembers. Through the earth, the footprints left by the indigenous people who first found this place, the water, the acequias pushing life into the desert, the people, the collective memory passed down, hidden in their DNA. You can hear it in the music, in the hydraulics of a lowrider, see it in the tiny sculptures of a saint. The Española Valley remembers, and while many of the chili fields have been dozed over and replaced by Chili's restaurants, while the water in some places has been dammed, while addiction, poverty, and loss lie just below the surface, that memory is strong. The past is what grounds this place, makes it unique. You can feel it in the air as the wind whips through the mesas and follows the Rio Grande through the canyons. It radiates off the small towns, the pueblos, the casinos, the graveyards, and settles as a warm breeze that comes out of nowhere and wraps itself around you and says, "Welcome." Some people call it tradition. Some people call it enchantment. But for the people who live here, it makes it home.
There's supernatural entities that are at work in all of this. And the Hopi know that. The people in the Pueblo know that. You know, my culture, praying in the chapels, walking the santos up and down the acequias, know that. Unfortunately, CNN, NBC, and Fox doesn't know that.
What we need is really a kind of innovation with tradition, a marriage of innovation with tradition that can lead to a more sustainable future in terms of our use of resources, in terms of our production and consumption of food, and even our way of organizing communities.
Evolution of species and culture owe far more to mutual cooperation than to mutual antagonism.
We're going to have to teach people again, and I think it's already happening, you know, how to live again. It's activism for the future, it's activism for the past, it's activism right now. I think it's the most heavy-dutiest form of activism.
You know, me, I've already, you know, sowed my wild oats, but, you know, there's still a lot of youth and a lot of power and a lot of strength and a lot of beauty and, you know, especially in this area with the culture.
To me, it's human ecology. I am an organism in a landscape, and I know my place. I have my niche here.
Española, The Land Remembers, was produced by Zach Rosen, with help from researcher Marietta Sinodis and senior editor Taki Telenidis. The rest of the So True staff are producers Tina Antolini, Brenton Crozier, business manager Bree Burge, and Ian D'Souza is our Sultan of Solutions. Special thank yous to Carmilla Padilla, Robin Collier, and Tim Force. Now remember, you can see more of Española and the other places we've gone to at stateoftheunion.com. So True is distributed by PRX and NPR, with major funding provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'm Al Edson, and remember, things fall apart. Our job is to bring them back together. Support for NPR comes from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world. On the web at hewlett.org. Kaufman, the Foundation for Entrepreneurship, supporting the entrepreneurs movement. Learn more at buildastrongeramerica.com. And the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. This is NPR.
In 2003, peaceful unarmed women took on warlords and the regime of dictator Charles Taylor, winning peace for their shattered country, Liberia. Our next community cinema screening, Pray the Devil Back to Hell, tells the story of these freedom fighters. The free public screening is at the main Champaign Public Library, Tuesday, September 6th, from 6 to 8:30 p.m. The film's closed captioned and the discussion translated by a sign language interpreter.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Subaru of Champaign County, now on Route 45 in Savoy. At Subaru's assembly plant in Lafayette, Indiana, a zero landfill status is designed to save cost and our future. It's part of what makes a Subaru. Information online at SubaruofChampaign.com or 352-4700.
Mostly sunny on this Labor Day, the high 69, north-northeast winds 9 to 14 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly clear skies, the low 44. Sunny tomorrow with a high of 72. Tomorrow night mostly clear, the low 47. Sunny on Wednesday, the high 74. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.